I would like to welcome you to the Mormon Folk Poetry Session, and we need to get started. We still have one poet that hasn't shown up yet, and we hope she'll come in just a moment. I'm Marty Esplin, and I'd like to introduce everyone, but first let me just tell you why we even have this session this time. It's brand new, and several Sunstone people and friends of Sunstone went to the Cowboy Poetry Gathering in Elko, Nevada, last January, early February, and we had a ball. It was just wonderful going into this culture, listening to their folk poetry, their poems, and the music and everything, and we just thought it would be a great idea to do this with our own stories, Mormon stories, and so that's how this was born, and we're not going to give up. Even though there are very few of you here, we're going to do it again next year, hopefully. And so if you know any poets that would like to submit to us some poems, we'd like to hear from them. I feel really fortunate today to be able to introduce Hal Cannon, who's going to be he's going to give you a history or at least some thoughts on folk poetry. He is the director of the Western Folklife Center that is in Elko, and he's published several books on Western folk art, poetry, and music, and he plays with the Deseret String Band. And I'll go over who our poets are. Dennis Clark is the librarian at Orem Public Library, and he is the poetry review editor for Sunstone magazine, and he's the past poetry editor for the magazine. Leonard Colson is here. He's a friend of Hal's, and he is a banjo maker, and he owns the Intermountain Guitar and Banjo Shop, and he also plays with the Deseret String Band. And Susan Howe is an assistant professor of English at Brigham Young University. She received her Doctor of Philosophy degree in English and Creative Writing from the University of Denver in 1989. She is the author of Burdens of Earth, a play depicting Joseph Smith's experience in Liberty Jail. Her poems have appeared in The New Yorker, Prairie Schooner, Shenandoah, Kansas Quarterly, Literary Review, and BYU Studies. She is currently fiction editor of Exponent 2 and the poetry editor of Dialogue and Literature and Belief. She won the 1988 D.K. and Brookie Baum Fiction Contest with Sunstone. And our other poet, who I'm sure will be coming in shortly, is Lori Johnson. And she said that she's a fraud and that she should never have said this, and so maybe she's not going to show. Maybe that's her poem today, is not show. She said she never was a poet, and she is a very funny lady, though, and I hope she does come. She did a comedy routine last year for the Sunstone Symposium, and she used to be with a comedy routine group here in Salt Lake. So I hope she is able to come. Did I leave anyone out? And Albert Peck, the reason I left him out is because, we were really excited about this whole session, and he said, "You write something, Marty." And I went, "Yeah, right. I'm the chair. You write something." He was going to write something, but he had some great ideas that just didn't quite come to fruition. But next year he is committed, that I'm committing him to writing this, the poem he was supposed to have written for today, for next year. I'd like to turn the time over to Hal.
I'm just going to say a few words about poetry, and then I'm going to ask Leonard to come up and recite an old Mormon poem, folk poem, and sing a couple of songs that are very interesting folk poetry. When I was growing up, I'd find my mother early in the morning at a table with paper surrounding her, and she was listening to music on our hi-fi and writing words down, and other times I'd find her just writing words down, and I knew that she sort of had an artistic bent, but I didn't know exactly what she was doing. But I found out later, as I was growing up, that she was the person in our ward who wrote the parodies of songs for road shows. And she was the person in our ward who, whenever there was a wedding shower, she would write a commemorative poem for the couple that was getting married. People would ask her when someone died in the ward to come to write a poem eulogizing the person that had died. And she was in a very unofficial sense, sort of the poet of our ward. And I don't think you could, if you asked my mother if she was a poet, she'd say, no, I'm not a poet. But she is a poet. She writes poetry. And very much she's in a part of a long-time tradition, which is a strong part of Mormon culture and also a strong part of Anglo-based culture in this country, which puts great value on rhyme and meter. And she's the person that I grew up listening to her poetry. In fact, I was married last year, and someone in the ward had a shower for us, and she wrote this lengthy poem about my wife and I, and she had all these little tidbits that rhymed rather awkwardly, but well, you know, we felt very good about it, because there's something about having rhyme and meter that just catches people. It takes a story to another level. And I think it's a fascination with this, the sound and the rhythm of poetry, that has captivated people for a long time. Poetry's changed an awful lot in the last number of years, and formal poetry particularly has explored a lot of new form and a lot of new kinds of formula to achieve its ends. But in folk poetry, rhyme and meter and rather simple ballad form is still the prevailing kind of folk poetry. When I was a college student living in Rhode Island, where I met Leonard, we were fascinated with the music and the songs of the Appalachian South, the Gaelic songs of Nova Scotia, and we'd take trips along with my cousin Steve Jardine. We'd travel places and listen to these very exotic kinds of music that were not quite ours, but had something to do with our own traditions. And it was at this point that we came together, Steve and Leonard and I and Steve's brother Mark, and we started looking at our own traditions, the folk traditions of the Mormons and the early traditions of Utah. And we started our band, the Deseret String Band, which has been going for a long time. And part of the research that I did in finding some of the material for our band was traveling around and finding the kind of poetry that my mother wrote and my mother sang, but of an earlier vintage. I remember going down to southern Utah and doing an interview with Carl Larson, the historian. He'd done a lot of research on Charles Lowell Walker in the Dixie Mission, who he said had written 2,500 poems and songs, usually parodies of songs, just about that colonizing experience of Dixie. And he sang one for me called The Virgin Ditch, which was a song about the building of the Virgin Irrigation Ditch, and it was to the tune of an older English hymn. The practice of writing poetry to parody popular songs and well-known hymns has always been a practice within the Mormon Church. The songs have changed, the popularized music has changed, but that kind of poetry has been prevalent since the 1850s and 1860s, when people like, was his name Ewian?
Ewian.
Published a couple of books called The Mountain Warbler and The Beehive Songster, which were parodies of popular songs but with Mormon content. And that same tradition you can follow very in a real way to the present, to the parody of songs in commemorative poetry and road shows and amateur dramatics in the Mormon Church. I think the contribution that we'll make today is maybe showing you a few of these real early versions of Mormon poetry, folk poetry, and then we'll hear some of your efforts. I'd like to say that poetry comes in a lot of different forms these days, and The value of folk poetry, I think, is undeniable. If you look at the history of poetry in the world, some of the most important poetry that we value from early cultures and the way we know about the history of the early Greeks and early England is through folk poetry rather than the formalized poetry. So I can't stress how important I think it is that we collect poems like My Mother Writes and People in Your Wards Write, and they keep the music for road shows, because I think it's an important document of our culture and something that should be preserved, and it's often the first thing to go when we collect our relics to preserve for the future. Leonard, do you want to sing a couple?
Sure.
Good.
What do you want to do first?
How about this one was, I have to say, this Ulrich Uyum, who wrote the Mountain Warbler and Beehive Songsters, his books were recommended by the Sunday School Board, so maybe that's a preamble to the song that Leonard will sing, which is called Amongst the Awful Mormons.
Start on all of it.
The Virgin Bridge.
Oh dear, I'm sad, I've got the blues. I've lately heard some dreadful news. I really trembled in my shoes. It's all about the Mormons. For sure they are the strangest set that ever in this world were met. They live in a place called Deseret in the midst of the Rocky Mountains. Brigham Young, he is their king. To him they tithe and offering string and heat and gold and everything in the midst of the awful Mormons. These poor deluded people say are all the world else in whole sway, and sweep the Gentiles all away and send them to hell in the morn. None but their behavior, they'll be the devil to pay if something is not quickly done to put these saucy Mormons down. Brigham Young, he is their king. To him they tithe and offering string and heat and gold and everything in the midst of the awful Mormons. In every nation of the world, these Mormons have their flag unfurled and send their missionaries round to preach their awful doctrines. It matters not which way we turn, nothing but Mormons we discern. I wonder how there came to be so many beastly Mormons. Brigham Young, he is their king. To him they tithe and offering string. He controls in everything in the midst of the awful Mormons marry many wives, and every man among them strives to raise the greatest, proudest voice and thrash the wicked Gentiles. And men and women all agree to break them. They'll only be and ask his little fingers crook. They'll bring outsiders all to book. Brigham Young, he is their king. To him they tithes and offerings bring and keep and hold and everything in the midst of the awful. So now I'm sure you'll all agree it is a shocking thing to see so many people led astray by their beastly abominations. I think this nation soon would mend. I wish that Uncle Sam would send some troops to make these Mormons bend to Christian institutions. If they don't, we're all undone. We're sure as light as from the sun. These Mormons, they will take away our glorious state and nation. Brigham Young, he is their king. To him they tithes and offering bring, and he controls and everything in the midst of the awful.
That, as Harold was saying about parodying earlier songs, the melody of that comes from a song called "The King of the Cannibal Islands." I don't know what it is about.
Why don't you recite that other poem that you wrote?
Yeah, this is another poem he wrote. Theoretically, I guess this would have been sung and to the same tune of "The King of the Cannibal Islands," but I think it's better said. This is called "Come Forward and Pay Up Your Tithings." Come, Mormons, all attention pay while I attempt to have my say. I've chosen for my text today. Come forward and pay up your tithings. These may not be the very words which ancient holy writ records, but Malachi, I think, affords a verse with which the sense accords. It seems that he had cause to scold the Israelites or saints of old. In fact, they needed to be told, come forward and pay up your tithings. Now if to prosper you desire and wish to keep out of the fire, nay, if to be saints you aspire, come forward to pay up your tithing. Just as it was in olden times with other saints in ancient times, the call is now, bring out your dimes, come forward and pay up your tithing. Our prophet says when elders preach the law of tithings, they should teach, pay up themselves, and then beseech all those that come within their reach, which makes me now appeal to you, follow reason, right, pursue, and whilst all evil you eschew, come forward and pay up your tithings. Now if to prosper you desire and wish to keep out of the fire, nay, if to be saints you aspire, come forward and pay up your tithing. Now male and female, rich and poor, who wish to keep your standing sure that you salvation may secure, come forward and pay up your tithing. One-tenth, that is, and nothing less of all you do or may possess, your flocks and herds and their increase, pigs and poultry, ducks and geese, one-tenth indeed of all your toil, likewise the products of the soil, and if you've any wine or oil, come forward and pay up your tithing. Now if to prosper you desire and wish to keep out of the fire, nay, if to be saints you aspire, come forward and pay up your tithing.
We're going to sing a newer song. This one was written by some early folks from the Washington area near St. George, and they were, I think it was Lott Alexander who wrote this, Della Turner's uncle, and it came, it was a song about sheep herding, and it was written by some sheep herders who didn't appreciate their boss, who they thought was sort of sanctimonious and religious on one hand, and not very fair with his employees on the other.
Sheepskin.
Yeah, that's it.
To cook maize. That's all in the world you'll ever get when you work for Granville Pace. The first day that I heard it, there came an awful fog. I, of course, fell short some sheep. I did not have a dog. When we got to the common hand, Gram said, you're short two sheep. Granville cursed and Granville swore he could not find the sheep. He sent me out a damned old dog. He said her name was Nell. First I set her on the sheep, she scattered them all to hell. I up with my rifle and took a shot at her. Granville never said a word, but he thought, you dirty cur. Dough gobs and foiled flank and castle blow 14. And oh, she fell, the ragged old quill for all who furnished me. A frying pan with a handle gone and old pot to cook maize. That's all in the world you'll ever get when you hurt for Granville Pace. On a Sunday we started for the desert, a storming like hell. Granville, he got homesick again, he said he wasn't well. He went up to Pinto and got in a heck of a fight. Came sneaking back to the old sheep camp in the middle of the night. When we got our new Campville, Grandma came around. It then being Christmas time, of course we went to town. We went out to Granville's to get a little fun. While we were sitting there in the war teacher's car, Granville said, I pray each day before I go to sleep. But he forgot to tell the time he stole Joe Prince's sheep. Joe gobs and ball flank and castle blow 14. An old sheep held the ragged old quill for all he furnished me. A frying pan with a handle gone and no pot to cook maize. That's all in the world you'll ever get when you work for Granville Pace.
Well, maybe that gives you a little bit of a background. I might read a poem of cowboy verse a little bit later, but I want to thank Leonard for leaving his shop and coming and singing a couple of songs.
Thank you very much.
I'm going to go back.
Okay. Well, let's proceed. How should...
Okay. Doesn't matter who goes first or...
Take the magic clipper.
What do you do with it?
You have to clip it to your lapel.
I don't have a lapel. Is this all right? Okay, my poem is The Elemental Test, A Mostly True Tale. Think back to the time of your childhood when in church you would hear grown-ups say that we're here so that we can discover if we'll live the commandments each day. Now, I've thought of those teachings quite often since the days I was sunbeam and star. I agree that we're here to be tested, but we don't know just what those tests are. I arrived at this pithy conclusion in the winter of 1985 as I tried to think what I could learn from events that I barely survived. One Sunday I woke to discover from my snug bed, all comfy and warm, that in the night while I'd been sleeping, there had been an enormous snowstorm. In the pre-dawn light of a street lamp, the world was a beautiful show. Evergreen trees hung down heavy under their burden of snow. The snowfall made hillocks of autos and smooth yards and streets in my sleep into shining fields, uninterrupted fields of snow spreading out 2 feet deep. Now, this picture was lovely and soothing from the comfort and safety of bed, but I was soon much disturbed by a question that wormed its way into my head. As the snow drifted down in the stillness onto pine tree and aspen and birch, I asked, should I, through this giant snowstorm, still try to make it to church? Our ward met at the ungodly hour of 8:30, almost at dawn, and that early on Sunday, the city wouldn't even have turned the plows on. Should I forge my own way through the snowdrifts? Should I take on the elements' dread? Or sleep in, get up late, read the paper, and eat breakfast right there in my bed? Then I thought of the heroes of Scripture, and I thought of the dam pioneers who were always out trudging through blizzards for the sake of the gospel so dear. And I thought that this might be a trial, my own little personal test. And once I had proved true and faithful, I'd soon be enormously blessed. So I rose in the dark just like Samuel. I felt righteous and quite pioneery as I dressed and prepared for the Sabbath, then went into the elements dreary. To uncover my very small Honda, I dug around under the snow. I at last heard a clink as the shovel encountered the hood far below. I dug out my undersized Honda, got inside, got it started all right, and set off in my trusty vehicle into the new morning light. Though the snowfall was deep as the tires, my little car plunged down the road, and I prayed in my heart that I'd get there, that I wouldn't soon have to be towed. I decided to go on the freeway, where the semis had packed down a trail. Once I merged there, I drove on so smoothly, I felt that I just couldn't fail to get to the ward without trouble, but I soon found out I was quite wrong. Down the freeway I had been traveling at 20 mph, clipping along. But that speed was too fast for the exit where there wasn't one tread in the snow. So I skidded and spun into circles entirely out of control. When I stopped, I was headed sideways, crossed the exit, and the car was stuck. I grew anxious trying to start it. Then I sat there just cursing my luck. Finally, 10 or 15 minutes later, a man in a truck came in view. He stopped to help me with reluctance because he knew that for him to get through, he'd have to get me off his exit. So he ventured to start up my car. He pushed me into the right direction, then he left and zoomed off fast and far. By this time, I was terribly flustered, but I crept on along to the ward and sighed in relief as I pulled in and parked next to a four-wheel drive Ford. Yes, I learned that I had been quite flustered. that spinning out had caused me fear and fright. When I came out of church 3 hours later, I discovered I'd left on my lights. And my battery couldn't have started a flashlight. The car sat like a stone. When I turned on the key, all I got was the feeblest sort of a moan. So I had to ask someone to help me. The man who belonged to the Ford had jumper cables and knew how to use them and soon got me back on the road. But before I drove off, he recommended that I let my car run for an hour. He said, "You've got to give the thing time so the battery can build up some power." I drove right on home very slowly. I arrived there without any harm. I got out and I left the car running, but my mind was soon filled with alarm, for there were my keys in the ignition, and careful soul that I am, I locked the car door out of habit, pulled it shut with a definite slam. I hardly dared breathe for hoping that I wouldn't be stuck in a stew, but when I checked the passenger side, of course that door was locked too. And there sat my car, idly chugging, with my house keys and car keys inside. While I was locked out in the weather, I sank down in the snow and I cried. Well, I finally regained my composure and went to the neighbors to phone a locksmith to come and break into my car so I could get back in my home. And in the next 2 or 3 hours, it took me a locksmith to find, a number of considerations kept running their way through my mind. I thought back to the first thing that morning, to what I had considered my test, and I decided that maybe not going to church was the course that was best. So these days, if there's ever a blizzard I wake up to on a Sunday morn, I get back in bed and read scriptures, though I might invite neighborly scorn. But if any mocker would ask me why I don't get up to fight and fuss with the weather to prove I am faithful, I'd explain my own reasoning thus. Of that 1985 Sunday, I remember a considerable bit. I recall digging my car out of the snow. I recall my fear that it would quit. I remember the instant it spun out, its lifeless and dead battery, the keys locked inside, 3 hours waiting, the locksmith's $60 fee. I recall the emotional turmoil, the rise and the fall and the lurch, but I don't remember a single thing that happened that day in church. You don't want to stand up.
Okay, let's see. Well, my name is Dennis Clark. I'm an inveterate unemployed academic, so I don't get much chance to lecture. I don't have an academy, so you all are the victims. First thing I'm going to do is disavow this. The reason for that is that it's not my work. I'm not at liberty to tell you how I came across this text, except that the person who possesses the original manuscript is planning to preserve it. It's stuck to her kitchen table, and so she's going to polyurethane the tabletop. When that's done, it will probably go on view in some museum. This is a transcription from the manuscript, and it's accompanied by what can only be described in generous language as a kind of peon to the person who preserved it, written by itself. I don't know the gender of this person. Like most folk poetry, this is the product of one, well, actually two people, two writers, but the product of individuals who deserve or who want to remain anonymous, and I think when I read it you'll see why they want to remain anonymous. It, as most folk poetry is, it's characterized by inadequate rhymes and inaccurate rhythms, and in general a sense that this would be better off sung And if I could sing, believe me, I would. I know from the same source, from comparing the handwriting, that this particular folk poet has also produced a poem called The Ward Choir, from which I preserved one line before the owner of that manuscript whisked it away from my view, and the line is, "How can someone so round be so flat?" That gives you an idea of the nature of this poem. The person who preserved this wrote an introductory poem called The Warding of the Ward Dinner. When I finish that, we'll go right into The Ward Dinner. I saw this poem while cleaning up after our last ward dinner, and so did seven other scrappers. But I was the lucky winner. Someone with pencil stubbed and blunt had scrawled it on the newsprint over gravy, potatoes, greasy spots, and McDonald's orange punch tint. I fought off brothers and sisters both to get it for myself. Half the others just wanted it to line a kitchen shelf. The other half were laughing as I rolled the tablecloth up, racing to read it before it was trashed or washed out by a punch cup. After my triumph, one high priest said that he could only hope us liberals wouldn't misinterpret this honest magnum opus. The Ward Dinner. The invitation said to bring your favorite dish for an island fling, what you'd choose to eat when you're cast away on an atoll for a year and a day. The ward would supply dessert and drink, but we'd bring the salads, green and pink, the tuna potato chip casseroles, finger jello and salad bowls, cowboy delight and shepherd pie, chicken divan and potato poi, turkey and stuffing casserole, poor boys from a truly poor boy, hamburger stroganoff or chicken broccoli and rice cacciatore, swaddled dinner rolls from scratch, steaming and basking in profane glory. Much better than if the dinner was catered by some buffet whose tots was all tatered. Even the pan-baked spaghetti was better. The cheese was drippier, the sauce was wetter. When we got to the door, we all had to swim for our tables. The baby I had to tow him, as the missus tried to keep our eight older children away from Friends Beach in Boulder. We was washed up near a crepe paper palm, away from those Smiths, in an island of calm, relatively, and wondered who would sit near us if there was anyone in the ward didn't fear us. Brother Axe prayed over the proceedings in Maori. His mission success blessed our tropical bowery. And parents in shifts herded children in schools past tables where they piled plates up like fools. A set of old grandparents, hungry for noise, joined us and set about spoiling our boys, who swum back to the buffet table for thirds before half the kitchen help served half the birds. The balloon coconuts bobbed above as we ate, bounced by a frisbeeing spare paper plate, and some kids played water polo with rolls. Some played shark attack down by our souls. Some kids were hanging from the mats on the walls, which we hung for the youth who play basketball. The crepe paper strung between backboard was drooping by the time they said, "Program!" And we was all pooping out in the heat. The teenagers were scheming to leave the primary kids running and screaming down front, while the sound system was being re-hooked up, and half the adults wished they had been booked up. Brother Anvil, the MC, he drug up his wife to the stage, hugged her and said, "All my life, this here has been my favorite dish." Made poor Sister Edna blush, but not more than their kids, their half of us parents. A skittish of youth who were plainly embarrassed did a play about shipwrecks. A trio sang Don Ho to the Swenson's Hawaiian Vacation home video, and Sister Axe, a mission trophy, danced a hula in Maori with the bishop, who thus made a fool of himself in the eyes of his counselor one. The sisters were glad Jeanette wasn't alone. By the time the bishop's grass skirt had fallen, any babe in the audience not crying was bawling. So we gathered our plates and we gathered our children and snorkeled away from our island pavilion, And we leave you this message to any who can read it. This is true fun. If you can't join it, beat it.
Hi.
This is Lori.
Yeah, hi Lori. This is the microphone.
Well, since this is cowboy poetry and I am an actor, I wore a costume. Now here's my costume. And since this is Mormon cowboy poetry, here's the rest of my costume. Put that on there. There you go. And also, in keeping with the Mormon tradition, I wrote this morning, so here we go. Oh, how lovely was the morning that first Sunday in July. As they left Relief Society, several sisters dabbed an eye, vowing to increase their efforts to redeem those who are lost, do temple work and pay their tithes, and twice a year defrost. Priesthood meeting had been peaceful with no rancor or debate. Lesson 12, male pattern baldness, is it preordained or fate? And the brethren were inspired toward improvement by the preaching, and some wondered if those foyer chats could count toward home teaching. Then we pushed through to the chapel with much loud and hearty greeting, exchanging jokes and gossip before testimony meeting. And those who had been absent due to sickness, golf, or trout, got the common admonition, "Well, it's good to see you out." The organ music on that morn, it even seemed more sweet. Sister Pratt hit some familiar chords and almost kept the beat. With tolerance and brotherhood and loves our bosoms filled, nary a child was crying, nor Cheerio was spilled. The spirit of that special day, was it too good to last? And hardly a soul was here to say, "Oh, flip, I forgot to fast." The bishop gave the signal, softly closed the chapel doors. "My brethren and my sisters, now the meeting time is yours." And instantly a brother stood and sprinted for the stand. In quick relays, the microphone was passed from hand to hand. The urge to speak had touched upon each member and his crony, each one more anxious than the last to bear their testimony. It wasn't just the spirit that inspired the throngs to speak, but more of a game of keep away from Brother Vanderbeek. See, if you'd lived long in the ward, you didn't need a warning. Give Vanderbeek just half a chance, he'd talk for half the morning. He was a goodly Christian man you couldn't help but like. You'd give him anything you owned, except a traveling mic. We all had heard the stories of his pioneer forebears. Although it once was touching, after 20 years, it wears. No one seemed to care much if the words were true or phony. Just keep it moving, that's the trick to fast and testimony. From left to right, with microphone in hand, the deacon streaked, tactfully ignoring dear old Brother Vanderbeek. In only 7 minutes, we could close with prayer and song. Never in ward history had he been still so long. The counselor nudged the bishop. "You believe this lucky break? Perhaps the old guy's sleeping. If we're quiet, he won't wake." The bishop smiled, well satisfied, and said, "Things are improving." Just then, the counselor gripped his arm and gasped, "Oh, Lord, he's moving!" And sure enough, the gnarled old hands were straining on the pew. Before our stricken eyes, bent shoulders shuddered into view. His old flesh was clearly willing, though our spirits all were weak. 'Twas 5 to 12, and we were doomed to hear old Vanderbeek. "Brothers and sisters," he began, not waiting for the mic, while every sis and brother there just longed to take a hike, "the Lord has richly blessed me. I'm a fortunate old man, and I'd be most ungrateful if I failed today to stand." Counting each one in his family, telling how he loved them so, he recounted everything they'd done just since a month ago. There'd been weddings, jobs, and blessings, and a slew of baseball games, amongst 8 sons and 50 grandkids, and he told us all their names. After that, he started stories from the first of his three missions, tales of healing and conversions and the time he had a vision, the food they ate, the customs, what they wore and did and said. Then he threw in his genealogy, both the living and the dead. All eyes kept shifting toward the clock, the hands that dragged so slow. It was 12 noon already, with two missions left to go. Along with our nerves, his lengthy, detailed stories still unraveled. Then brightening, he said, "No! Let me tell you where I've traveled!" He carefully described each mile, attractions, stops, and views. The floors were thick with toddlers crawling underneath the pews. Though I thought my watch was broken, sure enough, I heard it tick. "Did I mention," Brother V began, "the time I got so sick?" The teenage girls looked eerie with the way their eyes were spinning. Up front, the deacons hunkered down, all whispering and grinning. "I feel I must admonish you, for I was once a youth," intoned old Brother Vanderbeek. "I'm here to speak the truth." His bony, wagging finger pointed here and over there. "These girls are disrespectful! You boys have sissy hair!" By now, we'd lost all hope of naps and food and earthly pleasures. The chorister sought frantically a song with just four measures. And every child was whining. Several diapers sprung a leak. But none dare move and draw the eye of Brother Vanderbeek. Then it seemed the voice was slowing, something changing in the sound. And yes, we all could hear it. He was surely winding down. Thank the Lord, the words he whispered now were clearly leading to a close. Our hearts rejoiced. Some wept aloud. The bishop blew his nose. "I know I've taken up your time and spoken far too much, but I have a testimony. I will tell you now in Dutch. Van Dader is debitten." He began the spiel anew. "Oh, cruel fate. Oh, Satan's trick. How could this curse be true?" We'd sat there and we'd listened, though we wanted just to scram. No one knew a word of Dutch. No one gave a damn. We didn't care if he was old or senile, kind or meek. 100 desperate plans were hatched to silence Vanderbeek. And yes, you might have always known the lot of us were sinners. Forget the love and brotherhood. These people missed their dinners. Then suddenly, the room was still and filled with silent peace. Believe, you unbelievers, Brother Vanderbeek has ceased. The silence was a blessing, a great gift from up on high. Repenting of our evil thoughts, we jointly heaved a sigh. And all that he need do now was to say amen and quit and sit. But why was he still standing? He'd said his piece and quit. He'd covered all the bases, his witness he had borne, and motionless he hung his head all emptied out and worn. Surely he was finished, yet he didn't take the bench. "I have a testimony! I will tell you now in French."
What do we do now?
What do you want to do? It's pretty loose right now.
Okay, any other poems from the audience or any questions or comments? No, I was going to read a cowboy poem, but I don't think I will.
Oh, really? Okay.
It's not really a Mormon poem.
What time is it anyway? 5:30?
Do we get demerits if we quit early?
No. We can do that. Well, okay, I'll
you sure you don't want to read a poem? It'd be fun to hear you do it.
Would you do it?
Well, okay.
Okay.
I'll read one poem. It's not my own. When I started working with ranch poets, and this was an effort of about 3 or 4 years of field work, I traveled all over the West and over the years I've compiled a couple of books of poetry of ranch people. And one thing that struck me is how mutually exclusive our cultures are sometimes. I think if all of you listed cultural groups that you belong to, you'd be surprised how many you belong to at one time. So you can be a cowboy at the same time as be a Mormon, at the same time as be a person who belongs to a Studebaker Owners Club. The list can be endless. And what I've been surprised at is how many Mormon cowboy poets there are. And a lot of these people, it was after 5 years of knowing them that I found out they were Mormon, whereas in a lot of other contexts, you find out that people are Mormons immediately. And there's nothing in the poetry that I can see that that refers to being a Mormon in a lot of these poems. And I think some of these people write poetry that has to do with their church experiences, but they keep it quite separate. And the insider's information, which is sort of what makes it folk, it has to do with all the insider language of being in agriculture, or being a rancher, or a cowboy. I'll read one by a man who is an older rancher from Malad, Idaho, named Colin Sweeten, called The Hailstorm. I remember the deafening roar, the wavering fields of wheat, the huddled family, and sudden chilling of the July heat, and fear in my father's eyes, my father who kicked badgers and laughed at broncos. Mother quietly put her arm around him, as if she feared he might rush, bare-fisted to battle the icy pellets. I remember my father's eyes filled with tears as big as toadstools, icy tears which just hung there. There was too much pride to fall and too much hurt to retreat. And then our harvest was over. Our valley was still, so still. Soon the hurt was healing. There was no bitterness. There was no blame. I knew my parents still trusted God. Now in the quiet of my own silent hailstorms, when I alone am aware of the roar, I feel the strength from that old scar and find courage born of faith, not of understanding. Okay.
Sorry, Marty.
That's all right. No, you take it.
when Marty and I and Susan, we three went to the Cowboy Poetry Gathering, and one of the things that at least impressed me, and I think it was influenced them, was the effect of the power of the poem and the narrative story to let us sort of buy into the cowboy lifestyle, at least on a temporary basis. You know, by the end of the first day, or felt like we were one of them, like understood their worldview, and of course we didn't, but the story allowed us to feel a part of it much more. And that's, you know, I think that's what they did in the early Mormon tradition, but I think we're losing that folk tradition in contemporary Mormonism. And I don't want to lose it. And do you have any idea of ways in which we can reclaim that oral folk tradition given our contemporary urban suburban church?
I think one thing that would do a lot is showing honor and respect for people who practice the real ephemeral kinds of things that we take for granted. I just go back to my mother and her poetry. I don't think anyone in the ward has ever, I mean, they thank her for writing her poems, but I don't think she's ever acknowledged in the same way that people who have positions of power within the ward are acknowledged. And it's a very informal kind of thing. But I think acknowledging people's talent. I mean, I remember as growing up how much of what you're talking about there was. And I don't know how much there is in the church. Do you think it's diminished over the years?
I do. What do you think?
I do too. I think that
there's a problem in, you know, like I thought, the only thing to do is create little groups and make oral traditions with the smaller groups. Mm-hmm. It's such a big and diverse church that where are your groups, you know, that are going to have those kinds of traditions?
Well, the thing is, you know, just like bearing your testimony in Dutch. When I was growing up, I could see that exactly. That happened in my ward, what you were talking about. That was a story that could have happened with the woman who yodeled, and it was the Swiss woman who would yodel as part of her bearing her testimony. You know, and that's, I mean, there was incredible diversity in our ward when I was growing up, and still we had the commonality of the social experience of the ward. But I don't know how much I think when the formula of how you behave and what you do in church gets real strict, it doesn't allow for some of these more informal and off-the-wall kinds of things that seem off the wall, but and I don't know how, if the church has become more formalized. And
you don't hear in church talks, and this is my experience, is even the, especially for Mormons kind of poems, that, you know, the really strike poems, I don't hear them a lot as being read in church.
You're in the wrong ward.
Okay, yeah. I'm in the wrong ward. Also, my other question is, obviously, the group of people at the Cowboy Poetry Gathering, mm-hmm. the subset of the larger ranch culture.
Right.
And for them, they're telling stories to each other and reinforcing to them the value of their lifestyle into a world which may appear to them very hostile mm-hmm. to their life. You know, when you're there, you sort of get the feeling like all ranchers are part of this ethic which you're experiencing with this subset of people.
Right.
How broad, like when people are, and here I'm being romantic because I know it's curious, you know, people are out on the range, if they're like a resident cowboy, do they say when they're around the campfire or something, give them the poem, you know, Joe, or something, or do the recordings, or do other people buy the books? I mean, how broad is the celebration of cowboy poetry beyond the institutionalization of the gathering?
Well, most people in the ranching business have, at this point, heard of cowboy poetry, and you know, either they love language and they love story, and they go to a cattleman's convention and they hear it, or they come to a gathering. But everyone participates in it on some level, and they might not be active in it, or they might even make fun of it. But you know, I think that the reason cowboy poetry has been important at this point is just because of the pressure on ranching and the agricultural way of life in America right now. And, you know, I think that artistic movements, particularly in the folk tradition, but I think in formal art too, sort of reach their greatest importance when the culture is under a real stress. And ranching is threatened from all sides. I mean, in the last 20 years, one out of four people that was in ranching is now gone. Only 2% of the American public are now in agriculture, whereas, you know, 100 years ago, most of us were in agriculture. So things have changed radically, and they're getting to a critical point. And I think that the poetry and the music, which has always been a part of ranching, has become more important as the culture has been under more pressure. And I think that's frankly why, you know, Charles Lowell Walker wrote 2,500 poems in the Dixie Mission, is that, you know, that was an experiment that was incredibly difficult, and there was a lot of stress on it. And his part of his job was to relieve that pressure by writing poetry and speaking his mind, but also the mind of the people, and sort of letting the steam out. And I think that's true today, and maybe because there isn't as much pressure on the church, because it isn't in a as critical a position as it used to be, maybe things aren't as vivid as they were at one point.
Yeah.
I don't know. That's just very basic theory.
Any other questions?
Not a question. I just wondered if they brought any more.
Do you have any more poems?
Lori, how many more did you write?
I'll sing one. I'll sing one that I think my favorite Mormon poem that probably all of, well, I hope a lot of you have heard. Called Once I Lived in Cottonwood. And it was written by a dissident named Hicks, who was later excommunicated from the church, partly for taking attitudes like this song. But it was sort of the other side of the Charles Lowell Walker. He was the guy who looked at the more negative side. But it's a beautiful piece of poetry, I think. I hope I can remember it. Oh, once I lived in Cottonwood and owned a little farm. When they called me down to Dixie, it caused me much alarm. To hold the cane and cotton, I right away must go. But the reason why they sent me, I'm sure I do not know. I hooked up Jim and Bolly, all four to make a start. But to leave my house and garden, it almost broke my heart. I moved along quite slowly, oft times I looked behind. For the rocks and hills of Dixie kept rolling through my mind. First we hit the Black Ridge where I broke my wagon down. I couldn't find a carpenter, we're 20 miles from town. So I cut a clumsy cedar and made an awkward slide. But the wagon pulled so heavily, poor Betsy could not ride. While Betsy was a-walkin', I told her to take care. When all upon a sudden she struck a prickly pear. Then she began to bellow and she began to bawl, crying if I was back in Cottonwood, I wouldn't have come at all. Next we got to Washington, where we stayed a little while, to see if April showers could make the verdure smile. But at last I was mistaken, and so I went away, for the red hills of November look just the same in May. I am so weak and hungry now, there's nothing here to cheer, except prophetic sermons, which we very often hear. They hand them out by the dozen and prove them by the book. With me, I'd like some roasting ears to stay at home and cook. I am so weak and hungry now, I think I'm nearly dead. 'Tis 7 weeks next Sunday since I've tasted bread. Of carrot tops and lucerne greens, I've had enough to eat. Boys, I'd like to change my diet to buckwheat cakes and meat. Well, I bought this old short shirt with me about 2 years ago. And how I'll get another one, I'm sure I do not know. May Providence protect me against the wind and wet. These times for me and Betsy, I think I'll ne'er forget. This old shirt was dyed with wild dock root with greasewood for a set. And I'm sure the colors, they will fade when once it does get wet. They said we could grow madder here and indigo so blue, but that proved out a humbug, the story was not true. My wagon went for sorghum seed to make a little bread, and poor old Jim and Bolly long ago are dead. There's just me and Betsy left to hold the cotton tree. May heaven protect the Dixieite wherever he may be.